Thank you so much to Professor Sarah Turner for joining us today. She is a professor in the Department of Geography at McGill. Her research focuses on everyday livelihoods in Asia, specifically upland ethnic minorities in peninsula Southeast Asia and Southwest China, Hanoi small-scale traders and street vendors, and Eastern Indonesian entrepreneurs. She has completed fieldwork in multiple countries in the region and anchors her research and practice in local knowledge and day-to-day realities. Her most recent book, Frontier Livelihoods, Hmong in the Sino-Vietnamese Borderlands, that was released in 2015, is an ethnography on cross-border dynamics between ethnic minority Hmong communities in Vietnam and China's Yunnan province. She edited a forthcoming book, Fragrant Frontier, Global Spice Entanglements from the Sino-Vietnamese Uplands, that explores the modern spice trade in the Sino-Vietnamese Borderlands and will be released this year. So thank you so much, Professor Turner, for joining me today. To begin with, can you introduce yourself and your research? What are you currently working on, and how did you become interested in this topic?
All right. Well, thanks, Abiba, and thanks so much for having me join you today. So as you said, I'm a prof in the Department of Geography here at McGill. And as you can probably hear as well, I'm a Kiwi, so I'm originally from New Zealand. And my research, you actually summed it up really nicely. It's predominantly based in Southeast Asia and Southwest China. I work with individuals and communities who find themselves somewhat marginalized. And this can be due to the ethnicity a lot of the time, but it could also be gender, religion, or economic status. So currently this work is mostly with ethnic minority communities in the Sino-Vietnamese borderlands, so on both the China side and the Vietnam side, and also in upland Thailand. But as you said, I also have some work carrying on from earlier in Indonesia as well. And I also work with informal economy workers like street vendors and informal motorbike taxi drivers in Hanoi, which is the capital of Vietnam. So what am I currently working on? Well, right now, I'm currently working on getting my students through the year because they're exhausted and I just feel so much for them. And they're amazing the way they're carrying on and getting things done. Then I'm looking forward to recharging my batteries a little bit as well. But then I would like to start to write up some of the work that I've been doing on the impacts of the pandemic, actually, on street vendors in Hanoi. And I've got an amazing research assistant, Hang, who's been working over there and collecting interviews for this. I also have a new project that I'm hoping to start soon because I'm going on sabbatical next year. So that's going to focus on the impacts of infrastructure projects on ethnic minority livelihoods in upland Vietnam and in upland Thailand. I also have a project on the go about urban agriculture in Asia, which is actually based in Malaysia, China, and Vietnam. And I have a collaborative project, which is totally fascinating, on how urban childhoods have changed over three generations. So we're interviewing children, their parents, and their grandparents. And we've got case studies in five countries in the Asia Pacific. So I'm looking after the case studies in Hanoi and in Yogyakarta, which is in Indonesia. So it's going to be a busy sabbatical, but that's kind of what I'm doing at the moment.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. I just wanted, you cut out for a quick second. Your research on COVID impacts, is that in Hanoi?
Most of it is, yes. We've also been doing some comparative work in Laos and Thailand, but the work that I'm going to write up now is predominantly in Hanoi, yep, in Vietnam.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. I'm just wondering quickly, was there a certain thing that attracted you to working in that in the Southeast Asia region, or was it familiarity?
Yeah, great point. Well, I mean, I grew up next door because I grew up in the Asia Pacific region. And as a teenager, I actually had the opportunity to live in Malaysia. And I lived there for a year and a half and sort of backpacked around the area as well. This was sort of like my gap year between school and university. And so that really attracted me to the region. I started to learn Malay then. And then, I carried on for my master's. I did that in a street market in Kuala Lumpur. And then my PhD was in Indonesia, looking was at the small-scale entrepreneurs and how they were coping with Suharto's regime. That was the president at the time, who was kind of a dictator. So it was a pretty rough period for them.
So I'll get to the next question. You describe your research as focusing on everyday livelihoods in Asia. What research methods and tools do you apply to achieve this?
Wow, okay, so do cut me off if I talk for too long on this one. So I use a lot of different qualitative methods myself, and I love teaching about these. So I teach them at both the undergraduate and the graduate level. But I also enjoy collaborating with other researchers using quantitative approaches. So this is at the moment focusing on land use, land cover change. So I'm learning a lot about remote sensing and Landsat and all these other interesting elements. But two of the more innovative qualitative methods I've used include asking Hanoi street vendors to keep daily journals of their experiences, which was really fascinating to learn like the kind of behind the scenes of what goes on in their lives. And also asking Hanoi residents to draw the changes they've seen in their neighborhoods over time. And again, that was really interesting. And if I can just give a quick example from one of my students. So my grad students kind of get, well, hopefully they're already enthused to use lots of these methods, but they also sort of get a lot of encouragement to do this from me as well. But a former grad student who's just finished his master's, Peter Garber, he asked ethnic minority farmers in upland Vietnam to draw their relationships with water buffalo. And so these buffalo have really important roles for farming, like plowing for rice, getting the fields ready. But they're also really central for spiritual reasons, like they're used in a lot of shamanistic rituals and things like that. And so what we found was that the pictures that the farmers drew were really incredible and really powerful. And it wasn't that they were great pictures necessarily, like some of these farmers had actually never picked up a pen before, they were completely illiterate. But there were really powerful statements about their ties to the animals. And that obviously went beyond just being like, you know, a tool they were using for farming. So we really found that using like a participatory approach like this could provide a lot of deeper insights into local livelihoods. Yeah, and like just bring things to life, like the impacts of extreme weather events because the buffalo are dying. So like some of them had like really sad drawings about their emotions behind it. Yeah, well, I could go on and on about other methods, but I'll stop.
I think that's really interesting. Like, I appreciate the creativity because, like, as a development student, a lot of the methods that are focused on are primarily interviews, but there's this big emphasis on connecting to local communities and speaking the language and whatnot, and that's not always possible. Like, I like that you mentioned the participatory approach because I think that still includes local participation and being embedded in the local communities, and it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be from the region. You can still embed yourself as an outsider. And I just like the creativity, it made me think about. Thank you for bringing that up, and the grad student, that was super interesting. Continue on that, because you, again, work so much within everyday livelihoods and are in geography and whatnot. Do you see an influence of globalization on these livelihoods? How has the global sphere impacted their daily lives?
All right, well, if we go back down the hill, let's say, to Hanoi. So at a broad scale in Hanoi, we see that the municipal government is really jumping on this bandwagon in terms of wanting to make the city very modern and global. And they have this sort of aim to rival Singapore as a local sort of hub. But this means that officials are constantly trying to clear the streets of anyone that they think is too slow, too backwards, makes the streets look dirty, not modern. So this includes itinerant street vendors and a lot of other itinerant economy, informal economy workers. So another example of these workers are informal motorbike taxi drivers. And these taxi drivers tend to wait at street corners for passengers. They're all men. They tend to be in their mid-50s or perhaps a little older. And they're such a great service. Like you literally walk up to one of these guys and you say, okay, I want to go from here to there. You negotiate the price. Usually you sort of know what it should be anyway. And you jump on the back of the bike and off you go. And given all the traffic jams, it's just super convenient. But these taxi drivers or motorbike taxi drivers, they don't fit the image that the city officials want, right? Of this modern, global, clean city. So they're constantly being pushed off the streets. They're having to pay bribes to just like make a livelihood. So that's one example where you see the kind of really negative impact of globalization. Another one, I guess, that influences the same group of informal economy workers is the arrival of the platform economy. So app-based motorbike taxi drivers. So if you think of Uber in Canada, but it's like Uber for a motorbike. And these apps have had a huge impact on the livelihoods of these older informal motorbike taxi drivers, some of whom have been doing this for like 30, 35 years. And the app-based newcomers, they tend to be younger, they're really tech savvy, they have their smartphones. And so it's a ton of competition now. And again, this is sort of like globalization coming in. Mm-hmm. The local. Yeah, there's other examples from the uplands as well, but I'll pause there.
Well, I guess just speaking of informal economies impacted, what is the significance of them in the region? How important are they? How big are they? As I wrote, according to the ILO, the International Labour Organization, more than 68% of the employed population in the Asia Pacific region are in the informal economy. So obviously it's a majority of workers are in this economy. How important is it? And then what challenges do they face in addition?
Right. Well, yes. I mean, they're incredibly important, both as a way for usually lower socioeconomic class individuals to make a living, but also for many residents, like especially in urban areas, this is the way that they get to gain access to reasonably priced services and products. So basically kind of anything you can think of that you might need, you can usually get through an itinerant street vendor or other service providers, like, you know, cheap haircuts, you name it, an informal community can probably do it. But to take one example that I find really interesting and that I've been working on for a while. So in Vietnam's main cities, war veterans from the American-Vietnam War, which is called the American War there, and also from the Sino-Vietnamese War. So there was actually another war afterwards, which was a border war in 1979. These war veterans are allowed to drive three-wheeled motorbikes that have sort of like a trailer attached on the back. And they're really great for transporting small amounts of cargo around the city. So these are the only ways that residents who live in the really crowded areas in Vietnam cities, often down like really narrow alleyways, they're really useful for them to be able to get things like construction materials. If they have a small scale enterprise, it'll be the way they get the goods in and out to that, if like the enterprise is like at their home. Or if you want to move house even, this is the way you would tend to move house. You call up and rent one of these guys in his bike for the day. But like, this is such an essential livelihood for these veterans, because like they have a pension, but it's minuscule, and you know, it's just not going to help them at all. So it's just one example of how informal economies are so important for different groups of people. Now, in terms of the challenges, they're huge. And we see this happening across the region. So it's definitely not just Vietnam, it's like across Southeast Asia and also China. But we also sometimes forget about other informal economy workers that are not sort of like on the streets. So for example, cleaners, people working in marketplaces, and these individuals are often rural to urban migrants. Mm-hmm. And in many places, this means that they can't access essential services. So they don't get to access like just basic healthcare or education if they've brought their kids to the cities as well. So this is like a really big challenge that they face as well. Like, they basically are trying to make a livelihood, try to often send home remittances to families that might still be in rural areas, but they just don't have any support or just sort of baseline services to be able to do this. And this is quite well known in China as well. Like the Chinese, what they call the floating population from rural to urban areas, many folks have the same like problems that they face. There's been a number of cities that have gone into lockdown, and a number of the governments in these countries are far less democratic than in Canada. And so when they say lockdown, they really mean lockdown. It's not like just having a curfew like we had here. So this is actually happening right now in Shanghai in China, where they're literally locking down whole neighborhoods and people cannot actually leave their apartment to get food, like it's brought into them, things like that. So these lockdowns have obviously health benefits, because people wouldn't put them in place if they didn't think, at least, that they were going to be useful. But the problem is that the informal workers just get ignored. And so, like, these folks have had their livelihoods just basically ripped apart overnight because they're no longer allowed to be out and about selling, or people can't get to marketplaces anymore. But the government doesn't provide them with any support. And this is often, again, because they don't have the right paperwork, because they're not official migrants in the city. They don't have official formal jobs. Or they just don't even know if the government is providing funds. They don't even know how to get access to the funds. They don't have like the paperwork, or they just don't have like the smartphone that they might need. So yeah, people are really struggling. And some of the preliminary work we've been doing on this has been showing like a lot of people are just using up their savings, if they have any. Like, their savings are now gone. People are selling jewelry. People are now actually asking families that might still be back in rural areas to send them food, which is sort of an ironic flip of responsibilities, because it used to be the people in the urban areas sending like remittances home. So yeah, a whole host of different coping strategies they've had to put in place.
I was just thinking about also housing wise, if a lot of these workers come from rural areas or out from other cities even, that just must be another whole host of challenges, just because they're likely not in stable homes or in group homes or homes of a lot of workers. And so ultimately, despite a lockdown, they're probably living with a lot of people, I'm assuming. And I just thought when you were talking about that, that's what I was thinking of also. In addition, because like so much of their work is done on the street, as you were saying, and so when the streets are empty, like, that's
exactly. Both sides of that. I mean, yeah, their customer base just sort of disappeared overnight. And a lot of them, they don't have customers where they can call them up and say, I'll come to your front door. They are just used to selling in the streets to whoever's roaming past. But yes, you raise a really good point about the housing. Like, a lot of people were having to pay rent because they were rural to urban migrants, but they just didn't have the funds to pay the rent anymore.
Yeah.
And the people that they're renting from are not necessarily rich landlords either. So like, they can't just necessarily say, you don't have to pay the rent for the month or something. So there's been this whole spiral of consequences that have been really devastating for many people.
Yeah, of course. Transitioning a little bit, I was wondering if you could discuss your approach to development thinking and practice. You've brought up a lot of examples so far, which have been great, about local communities and their impacts. And I think that ties in a lot. So I was wondering if you could discuss that.
Well, you can probably guess from a few things I've been saying about governments that I take a pretty critical stance, but I also take a critical stance to large scale theories of development. So quite a few of the theories that idea students might hear about, like modernization theory or world systems theory, or even dependency theory, I'm fairly critical of these because they tend to ignore or brush over local impacts of globalization or other related processes like neoliberal change or neoliberal reforms. So what the governments would like to call reforms. So I think a focus on the local is incredibly important. And likewise, being really aware of what's called intersectionality. So here we're talking about understanding the impacts of a range of identity features. So this could be gender, ethnicity, race, socioeconomic status, social orientation, age, disability, and how these all combine to create really different experiences for individuals in the global South. But at the same time, it's vital that we better understand government discourses, because these discourses, the policies and the plans, they're all being implemented in different ways. And we need to know why, what's the thinking behind what governments are doing. And that means once we understand that, we can then see even more the impacts that they have on individuals and communities. And perhaps even more importantly, and this is something that I really focus on, is then we need to understand, again, the flip side of how individuals and communities respond. So one thing I look at quite a lot is this idea of resistance in everyday politics. So we might have overt resistance. So, you know, we have people that are protesting government plans and policies. But a lot of the time we also have covert resistance. So people having to come up with really subtle ways to push back against the state and reforms that are really hindering their ability to survive, to cope, to have a meaningful life and livelihood. So a lot of the forms of resistance that I look at, because of the communities I work with are fairly marginalized, tend to be these really covert forms of resistance. And it's really important if we're going to try to support these communities and understand them and try to advocate for relevant changes that we know what works for them and what doesn't to begin with.
Could you provide an example of covert resistance?
Well, one example which I find quite neat really is for the street vendors in Hanoi. They have got to know the daily rhythms of the police. So there are certain streets that where street vending is banned, but these streets often tend to be the ones that have the most customers or the most tourists. So like it's really tempting for the vendors to want to trade there because like they know they'll get some good sales. So the vendors have worked out, for example, when the police have their lunch break. So they know that if they head out between, say, 12 and 2 p.m., the police are not going to be around. So that's like their prime time to jump into these areas that they know they're legally banned from and make a sale. So it's like this covert resistance. They're not going up to the police and saying, hey, we disagree. They're saying, well, let's work around the rules in a way that's going to work for us and we can still make the livelihood that we need to make.
No, that's great. Thank you. That's really interesting. I'm glad you added that in. To my next question, to being practically a part of the development organizations, I'm wondering how it can be done, if it can be done on a scale of global development organizations, or if there's just more need to create smaller local ones.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really tough question and it's a tough call to make. It should be fairly easy, you'd think, right? And pretty straightforward to ground development organization actions with local knowledge. But a lot of the time it's not. And I think part of the problem is really bureaucratic and it comes down to the funding cycles of a number of these organizations. So it's not anything to do with blaming individuals for not caring or not having like amazing background skills. It's the fact that a lot of the time these organizations work on like a 3 or 4 year funding cycle, and often staff turnover is really quite fast as well. So to give an example, like I try to work with a number of international development organizations and NGOs in Vietnam. And for one of these, an international one that I won't name, I've had to explain the situation of street vending there, which they're really interested to help street vendors, but I've had to explain like the different laws, the different ways they interact with police, like these different resistance measures, how we could try to support them. I think over the space of 9 to 10 years, I've worked with 5 different program directors on this. And so I'm like just starting new every time. Like they don't have the background knowledge when they come in. And so there's little cumulative knowledge or understanding of long-term projects that could support street vendors. So the way I tend to think about it is, while I do try to keep supporting and working with these types of organizations, I also see it being really critical to connect with local universities and local students, because it's the local students who will often become.
So we have about 5 minutes left, so I'll do the last couple questions, and I want to discuss, as I said, your upcoming book that you edited called Fragrant Frontier, Global Spice Entanglements from the Sino-Vietnamese Uplands. So this is talking about nuanced entanglements among livelihoods, environment, ethnic identity, and external pressures, as well as other factors at play through the spice trade. And I was wondering how you came to this premise. how you decided to frame it through the spice trade.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm super excited. This book is coming out soon. It should be released in May. And what's even better is we were able to secure a bunch of funding. So it's going to be free. It's going to be a free ebook from the get-go. So this is really cool because we really want community or organizations that we've just been talking about, but community members and students in Vietnam and China to be able to access it. So this is neat. I should add that it's a co-edited book. So I have two editors working on this with me. One is Anuska Dirk. She's at the University of Zurich in Switzerland. And the other is a former PhD student, actually, who's now a colleague and a prof at the University of Ottawa. So that's Jean-Francois Rousseau. And then the contributors, so we've got 9 chapters. We've got this really great range of senior and junior researchers. Some are current or former students or postdocs that have worked with me and my collaborators. And we span authors from Canada, Vietnam, China, Switzerland, the US, and Australia. Now, well, the topic, yeah. So like most of us, when we're like going flatting or in shared accommodation, like we tend to have some spices in our kitchens, right? But I'd never really stopped to think a whole lot about how they got there or who grew them or what were the processes that got them from cultivators to like my kitchen table. So what we wanted to do in this book was really to try to unravel the mystery behind these spices and starting in the Sino-Vietnamese borderlands. Because I realized after working up there for a number of years that these 3 spices that were commonly grown in these mountains are actually quite common around the world, but yeah, we don't really know much about them. So we focus in on star anise, black cardamom, so not the cardamom like the green cardamom in your chai latte, it's a different cardamom that's used a lot in cooking, and cassia, which is actually what we most commonly know as cinnamon. Yeah, so we wanted to look at the experiences of the ethnic minority communities who grow these spices. They've got a whole range of different concerns that they've had to deal with over time, including the impact of climate change on these. So the book sort of starts really in the mountains and the areas where these spices are grown, both in China and in Vietnam. And we tie into questions of ethnic identity, politics, gender relations, and a number of different external pressures, both from the state and, like I said, climate change. Then kind of the next step is looking at the commodity chains that these spices travel along. So we go all the way from the upland farms through to sort of, again, the kitchen table and look at all the interactions along the way. But the last part of the book, we actually kind of flip the lens onto how these spices are marketed for global consumers. And we focus there on how websites and different marketing approaches represent both the spices and the farmers. And we see that often, having gone through the rest of the book, there's a complete divide between the reality and the marketing approaches as well. So we're really trying to hope that the book sheds light on the complexities of these commodity chains, but especially on the struggles of the farmers and how they manage to cope to keep their livelihoods going.
That's great. That sounds very interesting. I'm excited to look at it. And just because we've hit 30 minutes, my final question, which was, what is the process of collecting research for ethnographies? Feel free to add anything if you want, but you covered a lot of that with your like the different qualitative methods you mentioned earlier. So feel free to add anything.
Yeah, well, I think I'll just end by saying, like, to me, the most important part of the process of the type of work that I do, because of the communities I work with, is a real focus on long-term field work. I think it's really important to have regular visits, apart from when COVID's around, but it takes a lot of time to develop relationships and also to develop trust. So because I haven't really got into it too much, but like the ethnic minority communities in these borderlands, they're generally not very well treated or respected by government officials. These officials tend to be from the majority ethnic groups in both Vietnam and China. So it's really important that local ethnic minority individuals that I'm working with understand that I'm not connected with the government. Like I'm my individual personing, I have different reasons for being there. And part of my reason for being there, a big part, is to try to find a way to support their livelihoods in their communities. But I'm also really conscious that I'm a privileged white woman coming into these communities, right? I have my own understandings of what's going on. And so I really have to respect the information that's passed on to me. I have to be very careful in terms of the way that it's used, not to mishandle it. And I have to really learn and listen really carefully to people's experiences, their hopes, their desires. And one of the things I found really humbling is I've often had both informal economy workers like street vendors, but also like elderly upland farmers say to me, please, can you tell our story? Mm-hmm. Because people will listen to you, but they're not going to listen to us. And I find that really upsetting because they know that they're in that situation and they're having to deal with that on a day-to-day basis. But I also find that a real motivation for the type of work that I do and my students do, and I'm hoping to continue to train students to do really carefully and well, because these are voices that have got to be heard to make their livelihoods sustainable. Well, a lot of their livelihoods are sustainable, but for the government to understand this and to stop mucking up their livelihoods. But to get their stories heard and to have them heard fairly, then as long as I can help do that, I will. But when comes the day that these individuals can find ways to have their voices heard themselves, then I'll stand aside. Like, they are the ones that have the rights to clearly and obviously.
If you want to hear more from Catalyst, you can find us on Facebook at Catalyst McGill, on Instagram at IDSSA Publications, or at catalystmcgill.com.